Hi, welcome to the Let's K-12 Better podcast. This podcast is a project between me, mom of all capes, and my kids.
Hi!
In our podcast, we will cover a variety of subjects involving K-12 education and family life.
We will talk about the ways that parents, kids, and educators can improve K-12 education and family life.
Hit subscribe to get alerts when new episodes drop and follow us on social media at Let's K-12 Better.
Let's jump into Season 3, Episode 3 of the Let's K-12 Better podcast. In this episode, we sat down with David Olson, the Director of Education at Retroport, a nonprofit media company dedicated to connecting history to today's news.
At Retroport, David designs their free curriculum and professional development. Before joining Retroport, David taught AP U.S. Government and Politics, Criminal Justice, and other social studies courses at Madison Memorial High School in Madison, Wisconsin. We hope that you enjoy this conversation.
All right. We are delighted to have David Olson, the Director of Education at Retroport, join us today. Welcome to the podcast, Dave.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Amber, I've known you for years. It was about time I got the invite to the podcast. So I am all ready for you.
Oh, my God. Like, folks don't even understand. Like, Dave and I go way, way back. You know, when was your first year on like the iCivics Educator Network?
That's a great question. It was whatever year two was of the iCivics Educator Network. Because you know what I missed out on was the 1 year you guys did a trip to DC and met with Sandra Day O'Connor. I joined the next year and there was no trip. So that's how long I've known you, Amber.
Although consistently speaking, there were no more trips after that. So technically, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
But hopefully I can make it up to you moving forward.
There you go. Someday we'll get it done.
We shall. Well, let's jump into these questions and let's just start by having our listeners like get to know you. You know, if you're unfamiliar, like let's say you're a person out here and you're just unfamiliar, like what is the Retro Report?
Yeah.
So can you share a bit about the organization's mission and work?
Absolutely. So I, as you said, Amber, I'm the Director of Education at Retro Report. It is a position that has only existed since July of 2021, when I was hired to be the first ever Director of Education at Retro Report. Nice. The organization itself has been around for quite a bit longer than that. So Retro Report is actually in its ninth year. It's a nonprofit journalism organization that really specializes in short form documentary filmmaking. And the nature of the films sort of go in two directions. It was sort of started by our founder as a way to sort of check in on stories of the past, to figure out, hey, we all remember that thing that happened that was a media sensation that was, you know, that got a ton of attention. Whatever happened to that story? And did we get the reporting right? Are there things that we should have learned from that story that sort of got lost along the way years later? And that's still one of the modes of storytelling for Retro Report is let's check in on those stories of the past and figure out, you know, what is it that we ought to have learned or what do those stories hold for us today? And I would say the other way that a typical Retro Report story goes is it says, all right, there's this thing happening now that's really important and people are paying attention. What's the historical backstory of this event or issue that we need to know in order to give it the proper context? Mm. So So Retro Report, I mean, our stuff ends up on different PBS entities, on the New York Times website. We've had partnerships with Politico and Vox and all sorts of other organizations. And really what happened was they had been hearing mostly, you know, once the pandemic began, they started hearing from teachers who said, oh, I've used these videos in my classroom. They're really great. They're, you know, they're nice and short. So most Retro Report films are between like 6 and 11, 12 minutes long. So they're really good for use in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And they combine great storytelling with really awesome archival footage. Every time I watch a Retro Report, I feel nostalgic as a, you know, I just turned 40. And so every time I see, you know, old clips of like Connie Chung and Peter Jennings and things like that, it's like, yes, I remember having to get up and change it to that channel when my dad was like, hey, the news is on, turn it over. It's combining, you know, that archival footage, storytelling, trying to give history perspective. And really what the folks at Retro Report decided was we need an educator. If we want to grow in our outreach to teachers, we need an educator to help us do so. So that's where I come in. So I have spent prior to taking this job, for the last 11 years, I was a high school social studies teacher in Madison, Wisconsin, which is where I still live. I work remotely with Retro Report. So they have an amazing office in Midtown Manhattan, which I occasionally get to go to. But otherwise, I join right here from my home office. And so it's my goal to do a number of things. Number one, to do some creation of classroom materials. So taking films that are already in our Retro Report library and figuring out how could a teacher use this well in a classroom? What might they need? A lesson plan, an activity, other free resources to bring in to sort of build out classroom activities. I also do a ton of outreach with educators. So I go to conferences, I do trainings with districts, I host webinars, things like that to say, hey, here's what we've created at Retro Report. And by the way, all of it's free. Here's what you can use in your classroom. Here are ways to implement it. And then the third sort of big thing I do is help advise Retro Report and our team of filmmakers to say, here are stories, here are perspectives that teachers want to highlight in the classroom. So when you're making this film, you know, here are some ways we can, you know, adjust the script to make it more friendly for the classroom, or to say, here's an idea of a story that needs to be told that teachers want to tell and showcase in their classroom. Can someone go out and make it and find that story for us?
Sounds like you're doing some really important work at this amazing organization. I do want to just kind of ping our listeners back to season 2 with Dr. Katie Parada and her episode on historical empathy, because Dave just said a word that we love, making it real for whether it's the student or the consumer. Like, as you're looking at history, how do we think about the context? So I just love that the Retro Report is thinking about that. I love that you're thinking about centering teachers and their use of multimedia in the classroom, and like just even why that's important and supporting them. So, you know, shout out to you and thank you for that work. I have a follow-up, just, you know, thinking about, you know, you did mention that you were formerly an educator, all right? So shout out to those of us who were starting in the classroom and have moved on to content to support teachers. I do want to know just like what drew you to the field just in general of this social studies, civics environment? And then like, how does your experience as a teacher kind of inform your work at the Retro Report?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And it's one I think about quite a bit, especially because, it hasn't been that long since I left the classroom. So as I'm thinking about, you know, what are things that I need to create or resources I need to find, it's sort of always in my brain of, you know, how would I use this? What would be the, well, you know, what's my hook with students? What are the follow-up questions that need to be asked? I knew I wanted to be a teacher probably since fifth, sixth grade, somewhere in there. And it's one of those things where it was like, I had a really good school experience for the most part. I mean, middle school was, you know, sort of a hot mess, but,
I mean, who isn't a hot mess in middle school? Come on.
Somehow my oldest child, like, she's a seventh grader. She's loving middle school. I look at this human. I'm like, I don't understand this, how this is even possible.
But everybody get ready for world domination then.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. So, you know, like late elementary school, it was like, oh, I like school. I connect with teachers that make things interesting. And like, there's always a little part of me that like, I sort of like the performance aspect. I sort of, you know, I've always been sort of a take charge, be out front kind of person. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's certainly not something as a teacher I did every day, all the time. You got to let those students and help those students step up and lead. But it's, you know, being in front of the group is something that always came pretty natural to me. And when it comes to social studies, I think by the time I got to high school, maybe even middle school, it was like, yep, I think I'm going to be a teacher and it's going to be social studies because history and government, they're so interesting to me. I mean, I know one of the things I like to ask my AP Gov kids sort of as a intro to the semester, to the course, is to tell me about like your first political memory. And for me, my first political memory was watching the 1988 Democratic convention and hearing Jesse Jackson speak. And it was listening to Jesse Jackson in 1988 as a 7-year-old that got me interested in politics and in paying attention to government, paying attention to the news and incorporating history. Those are things that like give me life and give me energy. And one of the things that my students would often tell me, you know, especially in history classes, because they're like, man, history, I always found so boring. Somehow, Mr. Olson, you make it interesting. It's like, you know, I can make it interesting because I'm interested in it. When you have that passion and that interest for what you teach, it makes a difference. Yeah. I can tell you, I have taught some courses where I was less than enthused about what I was teaching. And I probably was far less effective teacher. I mean, when I, you know, this between you and me and I guess your listeners, Amber, ancient civilizations doesn't jazz me. Like when I taught that, so, you know, I was department chair. Sometimes as department chair, you got to like assign yourself whatever class is left over. And one year I was like, all right, I guess I'm taking on ancient civilizations. And oh man, I just like every day I had to muster up new energy to teach ancient civilizations. And I know that there's some people out there who love it and who get energized by it. But for me, like you see me in ancient civilizations and then you see me in AP government or criminal justice or something like that. And you can tell like, ooh, I know which one Mr. Olson is actually interested in because you could sense it in my energy.
Yo, that's a whole sermon. And also, I thank you just for your transparency, because sometimes people are like, I just love everything. And it's like, do you really? So like, let's dig in a little bit more just about like social studies, civics, you know, current events, media literacy. This is the place where the Retro Report is situated. How are these topics interconnected? Right. So, and then also like, how are they even applicable after this K-12 learning experience, right? Yeah. So like, how are they connected and what can we do with this when it's over?
This will be my short soapbox moment here on the Let's K-12 Better podcast.
Shout out to Soundbites.
Yeah, there you go. So And, you know, someday when I give my TED talk, this is going to be that TED talk. I think every single social studies class and every single social studies teacher ought to start their day with current events every single day. There you go. We are hearing snapping.
We are aligned.
Yeah. So to me, the key to engaging students, number one, and to making learning relevant for students and lasting for students is you got to connect it to the world in which they live. And sometimes the chief barrier is kids don't know about the world in which they live. So we got to build that. We got to start that and show, like, model some of those skills, right? So essentially what I did in most of my classes, just about every single day, when the class started, I asked the same question every single day. It was, what's going on in the world? What do we need to know? Right? This was the simple question I started with every single day. And you know what? Depending on the class, sometimes you had to prime the pump a little bit. Sometimes, you know, it took a couple weeks to make this sort of part of the cadence of the class and the clear expectation. But I sort of always wanted it to be informal enough that it never felt like an assignment, that it felt like this is our conversation and our time to learn, maybe before we get to the, you know, that more formal lesson or activity or whatever. And so I would ask this, and essentially I would depend on students to be like, all right, I heard something this morning on the radio, or I saw this headline on Instagram. I don't really know what it is, or, you know, I know a lot about this story and I'm passionate and want to talk about it. And, you know, I was blessed, I guess. I had halfway decent technology in my classroom. So I would have, you know, the big either smart board or television up, and I would have it up on the Washington Post or local newspaper, or especially when I was teaching classes that were more world focused, like BBC website or things like that. So students would come into the room, and as they're, you know, milling around, finding their seats, getting settled, they'd be able to look up on the board and, you know, see headlines. What are the top stories? What is going on in the world? And a lot of the time kids would go, what is that headline? What is that story about? Right. And then we'd go look. Or the kid who said, I saw this on TikTok this morning. What is this about? That's the way to begin modeling those media literacy skills. We'd go, okay, let's do some of that parallel reading and searching. We'll open another tab. Let's Google this. Let's see what we can find about this story. Let's see what sources are reporting this. It's let's build those skills together. And so for me, this practice not only was a great way to start class, but it always paid dividends, right? There were always times where we would come up on content at some point in the semester, usually like weekly in the semester, where we'd get to go, oh yeah, this is what led to this thing that we talked about in the news last week, or this thing sort of looks a lot like this thing we talked about in the news. Let's figure out how they're the same or different. Let's figure out how that thing we're learning in history actually matters to what's happening in our world and in our community today. And so to me, I think it's imperative that teachers build this practice into their class. Yes, it takes time. Yes, it takes, you know, modeling and practice, but it is so worth it. And I mean, even simple things like telling students, okay, take out your phone. What do you have for news apps on your phone? Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's figure out what are some trusted news sources. Put those apps on your phone, and heck, man, turn on notifications, right? When that big story breaks, make that what you go to look at your phone for, instead of, you know, what your friend down the hall sent you on Snapchat, right? Let's build in some of those practices where you go, yes, I'm going to be a consumer of news, and I'm out here in the world to learn things and learn how they apply to me. So not only does, I mean, that fits marvelously with what I do now, which, you know, my role is to figure out, okay, how do we help build resources for teachers to do this on a regular basis? How do we find those important things happening now and build in the historical context so that students can understand why it's important and how it applies to them? But these are also essential skills to learn to be a good citizen, to be a, you know, news and media literacy does not stop when you leave 12th grade, right? It does not stop when the school year ends. These are the, I mean, you know, it's obvious. I know your listeners know this, but like, this is kind of a big issue that we're facing in humanity right now is we don't know what to trust. We don't know where to get news. We don't know how to be good consumers of information. Well, that's at least partially on us as teachers. We got to help teach students how to do this so that they are well equipped when they go out in the world.
And I would say it's also a responsibility for parents to support those kinds of best practices.
Absolutely.
In a fearless way so that young people can learn those skills. I just want to ask a quick follow-up. Well, first I want to say kudos to you for having local, national, and international/global news available to your students in the classroom, right? A lot of times the focus is on one or the other, and oftentimes it's not even on local, right?
And you know, so a good tip for your educators who might be listening to this, one of my favorite ways to start a new semester or the new school year or whatever is you go get that like butcher block paper, you know, the one that, you know, get like a, you know, 4 or 5 foot sheet of paper or whatever that you rip off. You throw it down on desks, you form groups of four. I tell my students, okay, you've got 20 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever. I want 3 columns. I want a local and state news. I want national news. I want international news. And I tell them, like, if we did this at the beginning of the school year, I would say, okay, I want all the important things you can think that have happened since you left school for the summer. Or if it's, you know, for those folks who, you know, have different classes at semester and you've got like winter break in there, right? You give them 15 minutes and say, okay, I want all the news stories you can think of in these 3 categories that have happened in the last 2 weeks. Go. Right. And then you use that as the basis for discussion and sharing. And it's great to watch students connect with each other in those small groups and help fill in details or correct each other and be like, no, that's not what happened. Here's what happened. And then go into their phones and be like, see, I can prove that's what happened. Like you have the story wrong. Or, you know, no, it wasn't that guy. It was this other guy. Like, it's those sorts of skills that, like, you just trick them into learning and practicing. And it's a great way to start a new semester, a new course, that sort of thing.
Yes. Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you for showing that media literacy is a skill and a practice, not a thing that we want to just achieve. It doesn't happen magically out of nowhere. It takes work. So I just want to give you a shout out to that and say, hey, folks, that was a really great example of an exercise. So I hope you were taking notes. I really do.
I mean, it's, you know, it's a podcast. They can rewind if they were like, oh, man, I totally, you know, they're out like me. They're walking their dog, listening to the podcast and going, I think I spaced that last 2 minutes. I'm just going to hit that rewind button.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. So this actually sets us up really nicely into, you know, this next question, like, the reality of this landscape that educators are functioning in. It's a tough time, right? It's a tough time to be an educator, but it's also just like a crazy time to be like in civics, social studies, and history. I mean, like outside of COVID-19 stressors, we have like things like book bans, hostile, you know, anti-student policies that are being passed. And I'm going to say it like that because I'm going to say it with my chest. Things like reporting sites, right, where people can tell on teachers for talking about, you know, things like current events or historical events that make them feel uncomfortable or that, you know, are deemed inappropriate by some other person's terms. So, like, I really want to know, like, what advice you have in this moment for civics, social studies, and even history teachers?
So I knew you were going to ask this.
Other than good luck.
Yeah. I this is so tough. Mm. And I also come to this with a perspective of the place where I taught the last 11 years. I didn't have too many of these issues. Mm-hmm. It's not a community that, I mean, it's weird because it is a politically, you know, one-sided community, but generally not a community that, that, you know, is pro-censorship or is coming down hard on the teaching of history, especially difficult history. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, I was lucky, but I know teachers who are facing this. I speak with teachers on a regular basis who are facing this. And as cliche as the phrase is, the struggle is indeed real. Mm-hmm. There are teachers who look at things they want to teach and have to question, will this get me fired? And man, is that awful.
Right.
So number one, I would love to encourage teachers as much as I can, and as much as they have the capacity to be brave. That I think the vast majority of teachers know how to present material, difficult material, material of, you know, the enslavement of Black people in this country, mm-hmm. systemic racism in this country, and things like difficult or controversial decisions that the US government or other governments around the world have made, right. that you know, if you put nationalism to the side, people might go, wow, maybe that wasn't such a great idea. Maybe mm-hmm. we shouldn't have treated, you know, fill in group of people here in that manner. And in the hindsight of history, it was the wrong thing to do. I hope that teachers can be brave. I guess in terms of suggestions, advice for teachers, I think finding sources for students to analyze that come from a wide variety of places that tell the story of many different perspectives, number one, ought to be what we do as history educators and civic educators. But I also have to think that, like, at that point, your goal is not to tell students here is what you ought to believe. Your goal is so that students decide what they want to believe based on the evidence, based on hearing the experiences of other people and informing it with their own experience. So if we take something like, you know, the history of redlining in this nation, you know, that's something that, like, there's pretty clear evidence that this happened, that this was not only a racist practice, but an intentionally racist practice that, yes, had unintentional additional negative consequences. But that's something where, let's look at the evidence. Have your students examine the evidence. And if they come to the conclusion that this was indeed racist, I don't know that I put that in the category of you're teaching divisive concepts. It's like, no, man, this is the truth. This is what happened. To me, I think the more that a teacher can showcase the perspectives of others, you know, through text, through audio, through video, through pictures, through cartoons, that analysis of different types of media is what's going to help sort of buffer that teacher to parent vibe, mm-hmm. right? I think the biggest problem that teachers run into is when a parent with, you know, adverse intentions can come and say, this is what you told my kid to believe. Well, when a teacher is able to say, I didn't tell them to believe that, let's look at the plethora of documents and resources that your child examined, and let's figure out how they might have come to that conclusion. You know, this is one of those things where it's so we'll go out on a very small limb here. So my guess is you and most of your listeners, they heard there was a recording from a principal in Texas, right? This is probably 2 months ago, where the principal very bizarrely suggested teaching sort of both sides of the Holocaust, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Which is insane, right? There's not two sides. There's not a pro and con
right.
position to genocide. However, and here's why I'm going to go out on a very small limb. Students should be able to examine propaganda from the Nazis. Mm-hmm. They should be able to examine the treasure trove of records we have about how these decisions were indeed intentional and based on hatred and bias, right? If you're putting those things in front of students as well, to me, that's right. That's the other side of teaching the Holocaust responsibly. It's not just, hey, here are the heroes who helped liberate the Jews. It's we have to, you know, with an eye towards not wanting to traumatize students further, but like, let's look at what sort of materials actually got us to this point where yes. something like the Holocaust was possible.
Yes. Right.
So to me, that's where we go. This is where students need to engage in that inquiry. This is where students need to dig in, learn, read, watch, listen, examine, maybe some things that might make them uncomfortable, but it's uncomfortable because it's a horrible truth, not mm-hmm. because a teacher's like, hey, you're white. I'd like to make you feel bad. That doesn't happen, right? That's a thing that doesn't exist in our schools.
Thank you for just, first of all, thoughtfully walking that tightrope with the fire underneath it and the shark pit on the other side.
And I have terrible balance in real life, so it's really a trick.
I just want to acknowledge that for all of our listeners, because I think that what everything you said was thoughtful and very clear and just provided a really beautiful path to making this all work. One more thing I want to ask, you know, in your estimation of doing this kind of work, age appropriateness always comes up, right? So like, you know, can you sprinkle in your expertise or opinion about like age appropriateness? When is it proper to talk about some of these topics? And in what way, maybe? I mean, I'm like talking.
I know. Yeah.
You know, that's where I'm at.
But see, Amber, this is where we recognize that you and I have different lived experiences and different perspectives, right? I'm not only a white man, I'm a pale white man. I have two amazing daughters who are both ginger children. We are as Scandinavian and Northern European as it comes. It is simply a fact that my children will not experience racism. It's so I have had the luxury, and here this is, you know, this is where you get the cogent explanation of what white privilege really is. It's not that, you know, magical advantage you get somehow. It's the, hey, here are things I didn't have to deal with and didn't have to experience, and that my children do not have to experience. So I don't know. I mean, I think this at what age is something appropriate is probably different based on experience. And that sucks because there are plenty of children in this country who will have to experience prejudice and hatred before they have a chance to learn about it, right? It will become a lived experience before it is something that they have the luxury of learning about. I guess in all of my consumption of media, there's plenty of times where, you know, I've seen the memes of, you know, Ruby Bridges and people like that, where it says, you know, if she was old enough to experience hatred, your children are old enough to learn about it. And, you know, as much as I don't love the memification of society, well, I don't know, sometimes it's kind of fun, but
it's awesome.
But I mean, that's like, that's a decent point. I also think, like, I don't know, I haven't had the experience either learning, teaching, or seeing my own children learn where it ever felt like they were, you know, being blamed for the history of racism in this country. I've never felt like I was ever in a classroom where someone was saying, ah, yes, racism is your problem, David Olson, you caused this. Like, I don't get that backlash from certain parts of our culture. It doesn't make any sense to me. So I think the things you take off the table to make sure that you're doing things age appropriate is, you know, you take off any sort of simulation of someone else's trauma. You don't do the, hey, if you were in this position, write a journal entry about how you would feel. It's like, no, that's not going to be authentic. That's, you know, you're, I don't know what my, you know, white 12-year-old child is going to learn about it, pretending to inhabit the body and mind of someone who has experienced that. I would much rather that they be exposed to those people's stories. My own children have an incredible amount of empathy, that they can pour out, but they don't need to pretend that they're something that they're not, or have had experiences that they haven't.
Dave, thank you. Thank you so much. My kids are actually going to talk about a whole episode of cosplaying your way out of racism.
Yeah.
Just going to let everyone know. I don't know if that episode will be released before our interview or not, but, you know, just that is a whole thing. So I appreciate you saying that here, because we will then link this.
There you back. Go. Yeah. It's something that just doesn't need to happen.
Right. Why are we doing it?
Yeah. That's not gonna learn what you think they're going to learn from that. It's weird. So that doesn't need to happen. When I think of things that, you know, as my children who are 12 and 10, like when I think of things that, like, oh, they shouldn't be exposed to at certain points, it's like, you know, things that are overtly sexual that, you know, they haven't reached the age of maturity to experience, things that are like unnecessarily profane, and things that are, you know, gratuitously violent. Those are things that they, you know, that's what I have in my mind when I'm like, oh, is this appropriate for my children? Mm-hmm. Right now, it's also important to know that, like, there are times when you're understanding the terrible things that people have gone through, that yes, there ought to be some discomfort there, right? Because that's how you build empathy. It doesn't mean that someone should assign blame to themselves for feeling discomfort on behalf of someone else, right? But it's something that, like, yeah, you shouldn't come away from learning about the history of enslavement in the United States with, warm and touchy feelings. You shouldn't come away from learning about Japanese and American incarceration feeling warm and fuzzy about it, right? There ought to be a little discomfort, because those are horrible things in history. So I guess that's sort of where I try to draw that balance and figure out, like, okay, what's appropriate for my child or the students in front of me developmentally.
I love that. Dave brought the heat. Okay. So yes to all of that. I feel like you kind of touched upon everything from this question. So I'm going to move on to our next one.
Okay.
About, like, you know, which also is a great segue. What you said is also a great segue. Our audience is parents and educators and students sometimes too. What? Shout out to them. many parents haven't had civics or history in decades, right? Like, I'm trying to wrap my mind around that, but it's like a real thing. So, you know, what should parents understand about the importance of social studies and civic education and current events and media literacy? I mean, you said so many wonderful things, but like, just speaking right to parents about like the importance of all this.
Yeah. So number one, I think civic education, history education, social studies in general is essential for your children, right? It is like math, essential skill. Science, absolutely wonderful. English, literature, feeds the soul. Same with art and music and all of those things. But there's only one discipline in school that helps students contextualize their world, learn how to work with other humans in a way to become adults, in a way to become sort of fully formed as humans, and it's the social studies. This is the study of how humans interact with each other and how we interact with the rest of the world around us, whether it's information or the environment or, you know, any of those aspects. So to me, I think social studies is absolutely imperative for the development of humans and humanity. I do think for parents who maybe are a few decades removed from that sort of study, I think one of the most important things parents can do is try to build media and information literacy and responsibility, number one, into their lives, but also to try to model it for their children. And sometimes that just comes about in a weird way. Like, you get these opportunities to go, you know, your kid says something and you get to say, like, why do you think that way? Where did you find that information? Let's take a look at this. I actually was thinking about, this happened a couple months ago. So this is confession time, although it's now changed. So I'm pretty sure that I was the last human on the planet under the age of 40 that still had a physical paper delivered to my home. Now, I know, except I have since stopped that and I have gone all digital with my newspaper, which is a very sad day. Like, I love the newspaper. It is
smell to it.
Oh, I know. Yes.
Like a blanket. So yeah. Don't feel bad.
Okay. So newspapers, I love them. They're amazing. So I had, you know, the A section, front page section open, you know, towards the back where the editorials are, and editorial cartoon, you know, it was Joe Biden, an elephant, some other, you know, stuff in this cartoon. And my 12-year-old daughter comes over and she's like, what? You know, she sees me reading like the normal comics and's like, oh, this, you know, some of these are funny, some of these are dumb. Comes over and sees a political cartoon and is like, what is this? And I sort of was blown away that, like, you know, at the time I'm on the cusp of 40, I got a 12-year-old next to me, like, how does she not know what political cartoon, like, how is that possible? Like, this is a moment I must seize, because like, something must be done here. And so, you know, the educator in me kicked in. And so it was like, okay, who's this guy? She's like, well, that's Joe Biden. Okay. All right. And Joe Biden is he's the president. All right. And what do you think this is? She's like, well, it's an elephant. And I don't, like, why is there an elephant? It's like, okay, so now let's try to decode some of the images. Let's figure out what this is about. And I'm sure after like 45 seconds, she was done with this conversation, but I persisted. Right. And I'm like, okay, let's, like, no, this is important. This is how we learn things. And, like, you know, this, the person who drew this is trying to tell us something. They are communicating a position, a message, an opinion, right? Let's see if we can figure out what that is. It's those sorts of things that, like, yes, I get it. Maybe the majority or all of your listeners no longer receive a physical paper in their home. But it's these sorts of moments where as a parent, you got to go, okay, it's my responsibility to raise up some children. Let's demonstrate this and figure out how we come about information. I mean, my wife gets mad at me when, like, I mean, we have a political opinion in my home, right? But like, especially when my youngest child, like, you know, has a comment about particular politicians who might show up on the television, and I'm all like, oh, well, hold on, let's figure out what this person said and what they're trying to communicate and why. And my wife's just like, let the kid have their opinion. And I'm like, no, it needs to be a reasoned and informed opinion. And, you know, we got to figure out why people might disagree with that opinion. And so, yes, there's a lot of consternation in my house when it comes to, you know, like, it's good, watching though. The news. Like, I hope
okay.
so.
Okay. Yeah. Like, that's awesome. Like, I think a lot of families sometimes don't believe they have the time to stop. Right. And so right now in this moment, while I'm talking with Dave, hey, y'all, you have the time to stop. You know, it could be a 30-second conversation. It could be a 30-minute conversation. But we both are giving you permission to stop and have that combo.
And if, you know, if you're a fan of podcasts, besides subscribing to Let's K-12 Better, you know, find one from a trusted news source that gives you like a 5-minute rundown of the stories of the day, right? Like you have time for that, right? That's, you know, that's brushing your hair and combing your teeth. Brushing your hair and combing your teeth? No. Combing your hair, brushing your teeth. It's one of those. You're going to leave that in because that's, you're leaving that in.
It's not going anywhere.
Right. That's emptying and reloading the dishwasher, people. Mm-hmm. That's the amount of time and investment it takes to just like, just get over the hump. Just start this as a practice of, yes, I'm going to be a responsible consumer of news and information. Right. Yeah. So it's those sorts of things. There is time. You can make time.
Yes. Yes. And I would encourage you, the snackable news, like, yes, you know, commentators are great and all, but also get the actual reporting story so that you're not just always consuming someone else's opinion about something that's happening. Because I think a lot of us fall into that, myself included. Like, wait, I have my own ideas about this, you know.
Right.
Economics and, you know, war and et cetera, et cetera. So,
If you really want to push yourself, one time a week, go seek out an opinion that you know is different than yours, right? Go find an op-ed of someone who disagrees with you. Make sure it's one that, like, you know, they have some references and, like, they, you know, it's not just spouting. It's like, hey, I'm going to cite this study, or I'm going to back it up with some statistics. But do that. Like, find someone who once a week, find an opinion that you disagree with and give it a read, give it a chance. Right now, I could tell you, at least for me, when I start, like, the way I enter into those things is it's like immediately I'm trying to pick it apart, right? I'm trying to go like, no, here's why this is wrong. Here's why. But take a breath, take a step back, read it, process it. At the end, yes, it's totally fine to be like, nope, I disagree with this and here's why. Mm-hmm. But go find opinions that you don't already share, right? This is... If we're going to make any headway, you know, in the political division in our society, we got to develop tools to be able to hear and converse with people that we disagree with, right? There are some non-negotiable issues, and everyone has their non-negotiable issues, and those are fine. But then there's a whole mess of stuff in the middle where very reasonable people can have very different opinions. Mm-hmm. And if we decide to demonize on every single one of those little issues instead of just the non-negotiables, all we're doing is banging our head against the wall.
Thank you for that. Oh my God. Oh my goodness. Okay, Dave, listen, you and I could sit here for probably like 5 more hours.
Yeah, probably.
And have everyone being like, yes, these guys. So we are going to have you back. So I'm going to commit to bringing you back.
Brilliant.
But before I bring you back and before I let you go, I do want you to share where folks can find your brilliance and also what else you'd like to share with them, you know, just about yourself or the Retro Report or life in general.
Take Wonderful. It away. So people should check out Retro Report. If they haven't, again, you know, you talk about sort of snackable media, you know, Retro Report in the video realm, we're not TikTok, but this is not a, oh, I need to commit, sit down for an hour sort of thing. There are really great videos, on a variety of different subjects. Every single one of them will make you smarter. They will make you think, they will make you ask questions, and they're all in the like 6 to 11, 12 minute range. So go check us out. It's retroreport.org. I mean, you can find our work sometimes, like actually coming up not too long after we're recording this. We actually, in one of our longer pieces, we've got a great film that's airing on Frontline, on PBS. You know, people miss it. It airs or has aired on Tuesday, February 15th, 2022. It's called American Reckoning. It looks at this little known aspect of the civil rights movement in Natchez, Mississippi, and you know, sort of this battle between the city, the Ku Klux Klan, the NAACP, a more militant civil rights group within Natchez. It's an amazing story. So go check it out. If you want to check out our work on the education side, it's retroreport.org/education. This is where, if you're an educator, you can find not only a huge library of films, but also a ton of resources for your classroom. So full-blown lesson plans, student activities that are all set to go in Google Docs. You just got to make a copy and, you know, stick it in Google Classroom for your kids. Where, you know, other videos, we've got great discussion questions, comprehension questions, all that sort of thing. And really our goal is to just, you know, grow and continue to do some outreach for folks. So, you know, coming up in the month of March, we've got a three-part webinar series looking at the Cold War in Latin America. Coming up in April, we're hosting a webinar about teaching about immigration and migration. We've got a lot of stuff in the works. And the best part of all of this is it's entirely free for teachers and, well, it's entirely free for everybody, but you know, those educational materials free for teachers, to use in your classroom. And it's my job to help you along the way. So you can connect with me. You can email me at D Olson. I'm the OLSON variety, D Olson at retroreport.com. You can find me on Twitter. It's at David John Olson. Middle name is JOHN. So connect with me in any of these places. I'm happy to help. This is, you know, this is my work. This is my passion, my vocation. I love teaching. And even though I'm not in the classroom with students on a daily basis now, my job is to help teachers and empower teachers with great resources, to meet the moment.
Yes. Oh my God. We will have everything linked in the show notes, folks. So don't play around. Make sure you explore, check everything out. Also follow Dave on Twitter. And also just want to say thank you, Dave, for like dropping all this wisdom, for being so dope, like also being my friend and colleague in
Absolutely.
This space. You know, I am so like, yes, like this work is hard. You can't do it by yourself. You got to have everybody with you. So,
well,
you know,
it is
a shout out.
It is an honor to work, converse, know, love the great Amber Coleman Mortley. So thanks, Amber.
Thanks. Yes. Awesome.
Our family opened season 3 with a discussion on current events and what was in the news.
We know that the audio is a little wonky for that episode, but we model how families can have a discussion around current events. So we really encourage you to check it out. Please excuse the wonky audio. So what should parents understand about the importance of social studies and civic education, current events, and media literacy? We know that teachers get it, but what should parents understand? I think David said it best, and I'm going to quote him. Civic education, history education, and the social studies are essential for your children. There's only one discipline in school that helps students contextualize their world and learn how to work with other human beings in a way to become a fully formed person. And that study is the social studies. It is the study of how humans interact with each other and the world around them. It is imperative for the development of humans and humanity. So profound. I hope you're convinced.
Share your thoughts with us using the hashtag Let's K-12 Better. And if you enjoyed this conversation and you want to learn more, we encourage you to check out David Olson and the Retro Report. We've linked everything you need in the show notes. What's on your mind? Do you have a question, an issue, or a celebration to share? Send it to us and we'll discuss it. Share what's on your mind. The link is in the description, or send your questions to letsk12better@gmail.com.
All right. So again, you guys brought the heat. Thank you so very much for sending us what's on your mind. We just want to remind folks that we would love to hear what is on your mind. Whether you are an educator, a caregiver or parent, a school administrator, or just some other family member or whatever, a student even, right? Tell us what's on your mind. We're going to read this one from an educator. Again, we do not share where people are located or who they are. This educator says, how do we continue to highlight joy in our classrooms and build confidence for all students, especially when teaching with curriculum that is harmful to our BIPOC and other minoritized communities? I love, love, love this question. Gets right to the root at why we do what we do. So I'm going to go to Garvey first with a response. Garvey, what are you thinking?
Okay, so what I'm thinking is, in order to answer this question, we need to remember and realize why it's harmful to Black, Indigenous people of color. And one of the ways that it's harmful is that they don't even talk about Black, Indigenous people of color, or they talk about them in a way that is dehumanizing and toxic. And one of the ways that we can highlight joy in our classrooms and build the confidence for those students in particular is by telling the stories correctly, but also acknowledging their humanity, if you know what I'm saying. Like during slavery, when we talked about it in class, my teacher acknowledged the humanity of all of the people who were enslaved, which, I mean, it helps, but it's not the whole thing that we can do to fix the whole problem.
I think that that's beautiful. I want to ask you a follow-up. Does it harm white students when teachers are able to center the humanity of BIPOC students?
So I don't think it does. Not that I've seen, obviously. And I think this is because white students are already equipped with the things that they need to succeed.
How are they equipped?
Oh, well.
Just curious.
Oh, yeah. For example, again, I'm going to go back to history class. Christopher Columbus, like seeing somebody
discover something.
Yeah. Even though they didn't discover it, they literally killed so many people who are Indigenous people. I feel like that's one of the ways that instills confidence in them. I don't know, because you're saying a story about somebody who supposedly, which they didn't, do something good, and you're like, oh, like this guy looks like me, he's also white, and he did something good. But I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I totally know what you're saying, and I really appreciate the framing of, you know, victory narratives, the way in which we have always told history through victory narratives, have supported the confidence, the development, the interest potentially, not always, right? A lot of white students are like, I don't like school, right? But when we tell victory narratives, it's often at the expense of our BIPOC students, mm-hmm. right? Okay, so I just want to make sure I'm getting your point. Yeah, that's
exactly what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
And at, if we're going back to the Christopher Columbus thing, it's the expense, it's at the expense of people who are indigenous. Like, again, we don't, just now, we just started talking about how he brutally murdered people, amputated people just because they didn't do what he said, like... And yeah. in some ways, some people could think, oh, that's just, like, making it worse. Now they're not confident anymore. But there's other ways to, like, find confidence, especially, again, like, acknowledging the humanity of people, stuff like that.
I really appreciate your response. Thank you so very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Naima, I'm going to ask you this same question, you know, that this educator posed. How do we continue to highlight joy in our classrooms and build confidence for all students, especially when teaching with curriculum that is harmful to BIPOC and other minoritized communities? What do you think?
I think we can use, we can put it in a way so that we can use a lesson to make students kind of like help them find, like figure out themselves, I guess, mm-hmm. like find out more about themselves and what is being taught in the position of how would this be like, how would a person who looks like me or who is like me react in this situation?
So connecting the student's first person experience to the lesson.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that so much. Thank you so much. All right, Sophia, last but not least, I'm going to pose the same question to you. All right. What do you think?
I think that if teachers teach in a respectful way to students in the BIPOC community and the BIPOC community itself, mm-hmm. Like, I think that it's okay for, like for teachers and students to, like, do those activities and learn.
So you're talking about making sure that educators learn about the community of students in which they're sharing, they're teaching.
Yeah.
Okay. I love that too.
And sorry, one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
But like, for example, like if someone like in the class is a part of the BIPOC community and they're like, they want to share something about the BIPOC community, you should like maybe let them share or do an activity on that.
Oh, so allowing students to then also express themselves and share their culture with their classmates in a safe way.
Yes.
Sis, go off. I love it. I think my kids have covered everything. Making sure that narratives are inclusive and expansive, that we are not creating marginalized experiences through the ways in which we push out curriculum or teach certain events. Centering the students' individual experience and providing opportunities for young people to explore who they are within the context of our larger community. And for us in the United States, it would be, you know, who am I in the United States, right? And then also thinking about the ways in which we as educators get to know the communities and honor and respect the communities in which our students come from. So I think they covered it. The only other thing I would say, you know, as far as how do we continue to highlight joy in our classrooms and build confidence for all students, expanding what resources we use. So it's so timely that, you know, David was here with us in this interview to discuss what the Retro Report shares. I would say find other free, hopefully nonpartisan resources that do a great job of being culturally relevant, responsive, and affirming. Those are not bad words. Those are words that make sure that the young people who are receiving that information is information that provides care and love and affirmations around who they are as they learn challenging narratives about our country. So we're not holding back any information from them or sugarcoating anything, but we are honoring their humanity as they go on this learning journey with the hope and intention that they can transform our society for the better, right? So my only cherry on top of all the amazing things that my kids shared, expansive and inclusive narratives, individuals, making sure that our young people understand that they are part of this story, and then also honoring our students and the communities they come from. The only thing I'd add, make sure that you support all of that work through reputable, nonpartisan, engaging, awesome resources. All right, we've reached the part of the show where we're gonna... Y'all are so giggly. All right, I'm not re-recording this. Anyway, I want to know, what do we hope for our listeners until we see them again? So, Soaps, what do you hope for our listeners?
I hope that our listeners, I hope that everybody has a great week, and I hope everybody reads really good books. And sorry we didn't do the part of the show where we talk about the books we did, but I hope everybody has a great week, and, just go outside. It's spring, guys. It was spring on, the 20th, so...
Equinox came.
Yeah, no. We don't have an excuse anymore.
Get outside.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. All right, Garvey, you're up next. What do you hope for our listeners until the next time that we're with them again?
So today's question was really thoughtful, and so I hope that everybody who, listens is applying it to their situation, even if they're not an educator. And yeah.
Yeah, I love that. So just making sure the way that in which we deliver curriculum and narratives is culturally responsive and affirming for all students. Love that. Thank you. All right, Naima, what do you hope for our listeners until we're with them again?
I just have to say, to counteract a previous statement,
oh my God.
Do not go outside.
Go outside, everybody.
It's too dangerous out there. You know,
it
you
really
don't know.
Is it. Stop.
You don't know what's out there.
What do you hope for our listeners?
Drink water.
All right.
Mic drop.
All right, perfect. Thank you. Here's what I hope for y'all listening. You know, I just hope that you are able to take a moment and reflect and just be thankful for every opportunity you have to spend with the young people in your life. Our time is limited. As you can hear, my child is singing in the background. And we don't really have as much time as we think we have to make lasting impact in the lives of the young people that we care about or that are in our care. So just make the most of each second, each minute. Find joy in those seconds and minutes. Exude love in those seconds and minutes, and just, I don't know, enjoy your time together.
Thank you for listening to the Let's K-12 Better podcast. You made it to the end. Please like, subscribe, and share.
We want to hear from you. Connect with us on social media at Let's K-12 Better on all social media platforms, or connect with me on Twitter, Instagram, and Clubhouse at Mom of All Capes. The Let's K-12 Better podcast is available on every podcasting platform. So if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review our podcast. This is a family project, and your feedback helps us grow. Thank you so much for listening.
See you next time.